Welcome to Poetry Lectures, a series of lectures by poets, scholars, and educators, presented by PoetryFoundation.org. In this program, we hear poet Brenda Hillman speaking at the University of California, Berkeley. Brenda Hillman was born in Arizona in 1951 and studied at Pomona College in California and the University of Iowa. She is the Olivia Philippi Professor of Poetry at St. Mary's College in Moraga, California, where she has taught creative writing since 1984. Hillman is the author of 8 books of poetry and the editor of a collection of poems by Emily Dickinson. She lives in Northern California and is married to the former poet laureate Robert Haas. Hillman was speaking in 2006 at the Judith Lee Stronach Memorial Lectures on the Teaching of Poetry, which celebrates the life of arts patron and human rights activist Judith Lee Stronach. Hillman's lecture is entitled Cracks in the Oracle Bone, Teaching Certain Contemporary Poems. In it, she examines 4 contemporary poems through the innovations and lessons of modernism. Hillman begins her talk with an anecdote concerning former Attorney General John Ashcroft. Here is Brenda Hillman.
When I began to work on this lecture some time ago, I just received an email saying that former Attorney General John Ashcroft, having retired from the cabinet, is seriously hoping to be selected as the Poet Laureate of the United States. Ashcroft's best-known poem, entitled Let the Eagle Soar, was used as President Bush's swearing-in ceremony. Let the eagle soar like she's never soared before, from rocky coast to golden shore. Let the mighty eagle soar, soar with healing in her wings, as the land beneath her sings. Only God, no other kings. This country's far too young to die. We've still got a lot of climbing to do. falling off there. And we can make it if we try. Built by toils and struggles, God has led us through. I don't want to spend too much time analyzing this poem. It makes a straightforward patriotic statement based on an image of a bird. It rhymes. The problem here isn't straightforwardness or rhyming or birds. Dickinson, Hopkins, and Frost all employ these things. The problem is that Mr. Ashcroft has not used his imagination in his poem. He needs to sign up for my introductory creative writing course at St. Mary's, where we could help him in just 2 weeks. The fact that Ashcroft wants to represent American poetry officially and to be its servant is a frightening thought. His poem reminds me of the 21-year-old pipe bomber planting his bombs all over the Kansas countryside in the shape of a gigantic smiley face. The world quite literally suffers from lack of imagination. Here is a poem with imagination written by a poet in Wisconsin, Lisa Fishman, called Note. Was wintered in and made of stone and what not. This compact poem, like the inverse of a dreamed place, invites a sense of uncertainty and of safety. Its 3-line form suggests haiku, but it is not haiku. The lines hold an unbalanced number of stresses, 2, 3, 1. The poem has neither noun nor pronoun for its subject. Who is speaking? It begins mid-thought. Someone or something has been entrapped by winter. The second line, after an implied comma, seems an extension of the first thought. The someone or something being unmade of stone is either being released from a previous condition of being made of stone, or the unmade means not yet made. The third thought perception is the colloquial, but not current, what not, broken in half by a hyphen. What not points to the tentative quality of the initial perceptions. To live without expectation seems a particular terror and amazement in this brief structure. Could the same thought have been expressed any other way than in these 9 words? A poem cannot be paraphrased, but it can be described, its effects analyzed to heighten appreciation for how such a delicate mechanism plays itself out. In poems, the meanings coincide with the rhythms of someone thinking them. They are the subject of their own making. My argument for this talk stems from the idea that it is all right for poetry to have made it into the 20th century and beyond, and that it is a healthy thing for us that all, that poetry engages with complexity, that this complexity is both practical and aesthetically pleasing in ways that offer beginning and advanced readers more reality. Complexity and simplicity are not mutually exclusive. Paradoxical inevitability and openness of poetic expression make it both satisfying and mysteriously difficult to teach. To engage the mysterious or the difficult is not such a bad thing. It is mysterious and difficult to be alive and to express why. For the lover of poetry, there is a disequilibrium between himself and the world that nothing satisfies but poetry. The Stronach lectures were meant to address issues of teaching poetry for audiences that might have both scholarly and non-scholarly interests in the subject. I want to approach the topic in a fairly intuitive and non-technical manner and to present four survival tools for contemporary culture that poetry is especially good at providing. The sense of who we are in our historical, cultural, and for want of a better term, natural, but I really mean non-man-made environments. The power of language of each word and phrase. The ability to think through emotion on many levels, literal, abstract, concrete, metaphysical, figurative, and four, an awareness of how particular and odd everything is in compressed forms that reflect this as moments of thought captured in time. I think about these things when composing my own poetry and when teaching at all levels. Poetry is the most powerful method I've found for expressing the particular and extreme states life has to offer. The idea for this talk came from hearing hundreds of questions over several decades, not only in the classroom, but in conversations with friends and strangers about the challenges of current poetry. I can't say I read much poetry. It really kind of loses me, someone will say. Why can't they just say it normally? Or, am I supposed to feel stupid when I read this? Asked a friend recently. The topic also came up in a stimulating lunchtime conversation I had with Judith in the late 90s. We discussed stylistic difficulties of poetry in relation to states of mental suffering. Judith was troubled by a struggle she was having understanding a particular poem, and she asked whether poetry might not have a special obligation to present directly what might seem inexpressible. I said I thought poetry has the obligation to try to express what cannot be expressed, but that it cannot always be done in direct ways. We talked about how the confusion of daily life, the impossibilities, the unredeemed moments of spiritual darkness, as well as massive social and political injustices, could all find shapes in poetry. I know Judith wrestled with these things, and I thought of this lecture as a way of finishing that conversation with her. Thinking about stylistic difficulty and the ineffable in poetry resonates with other types of hermeneutical reading I've done for decades, including literary theory, Gnostic and occult writings of the second centuries, spam sent by pharmaceutical companies, and instructions for various pieces of technology. I would also say that all of these require considerably more interpretation than poetry. A while back, my husband showed me a thrilling article in the magazine Representations by David Keatley, a Berkeley scholar, about the origins of writing in ancient China. I will try to summarize a few of its main points. Keatley shows the connection between the worship of the bones of ancestors, divination by fire, pyromancy, and the development of writing in Neolithic Chinese culture. In the Shang Dynasty, that's 1200 BC to 1050 BC, around the time of the expulsion of the Jews from Egypt and of the Trojan Wars, ancestral bones exhumed from burial grounds, reburied and exhumed again, were burned for the purposes of divination so worshippers could determine the desires of their ancestors. After the diviners interpreted the messages from burned stress cracks, the sounds of their spoken prophecies were carved deeply into the bones and emphasized with ink. From these painted carvings, the written Chinese language began to develop. Keatley notes that these rituals of divination and writing were open only to a few, and the interpretation remained a specialized field. He notes that Chinese writing kept the power of knowledge specific to the scholar classes over the centuries. It seems these individual logographic signs were different from the alphabetic or syllabary scripts in other cultures. Microsoft has not recognized syllabary and has just tried to substitute salability in my laptop. For instance, those in Mesopotamia that combined syllables or signs to make meaning, nor were they pictographic. Each sign came with a single sound and a prediction with its own meaning. When Bob and I were in Paris last summer, we visited the Asian Museum and saw some of these amazing bones and turtle shells. And my breath was taken away. And I can just not recommend this highly enough. Go to the Asian Museum and look in the cases. These beautiful little objects, they're very small, but the carvings are just very intricate and amazing. They're like tracks of small animals surrounding their own absence. The ability to produce and to interpret the cracks, to utter the sounds from the dead, and to carve the encoded signs became the most valued form of literacy. The signs produced in this manner were more stylized and abstract than those of ordinary writing at the time. Because they came directly from the ancestors whose power was considered to be of an abstracted nature, unlike the Egyptian and Greek idea of the particularized soul after death, or our inherited idea. These writings had a powerful aesthetic function in the culture. I'm intrigued by this idea of purely abstract sound-based script, the signals to and from the ancestors. The value of these markings lay in their very mystery and abstraction, and the accompanying sacred sounds had a social function. This oracle bone script takes place between words and music. A few weeks ago, a poet friend, Lauren Lovato, gave me an article about the development of Nushu, an encoded secret script developed more recently by women in the mountains of southern China for the purpose of sending secret messages men can't read. So it's just a code sent back and forth between women. It is thought that this script developed from the oracle bone tradition. The figures are graceful and stylized, even more than the bone scratches. Bird prints, chevrons, spiked angles. Both these scripts seem like modernist practice in the 20th century. And as Robert Kaufman reminds us, that Theodor Adorno reminds us, the vast expressiveness of the abstract and the lyric, as in Kandinsky paintings, helps aesthetic culture reconceive its social function. Both the oracle bone signs and Nushu script remind me of Mandelstam's poems criticizing Stalin in secret metaphors, and of reports that servicemen in Iraq are doing highly encoded rap and hip-hop in order to express criticism of the military hierarchy and the presence of multinational corporations benefiting from their labors. One of the big jobs of a teacher is to convince students that any effort is whatsoever is worth it. Some of my students are afraid when they think they are supposed to understand contemporary poetry and can't. Scant or oblique styles of poetry make them feel stupid, even if the very same techniques are used in music videos. The students grow impatient in an increasingly impatient culture, believing that if the poetry doesn't have immediate appeal, it is undemocratic and ungenerous. Even some grown-up famous poets also put forth these opinions. Poetry should be easy, should give a quick story, should never make them feel stupid, as if a highbrow or academic trick is being played on them. The fearful student and fearful famous poet need a small review of the basics of 20th century modernism, which redefine the nature of art in several important ways. In light of, or in dark of, the First World War, modernism broke from the past, but also brought new consciousness of cultural history. Think Art Deco with its Egyptian motifs. It brought an interest through Freud, but not only through Freud, in the mind's psychological processes, so the ensuing art displayed more interest in mental process, and it redefined what it means to create by redefining God and nature. And finally, it recognized that the modern city, people living as alienated beings in the city was as important to the subject matter of aesthetic expression as rural scenes had been to pastoral traditions. And I highly recommend Charlie Altieri's, I brought it up here to show you, The Art of 20th Century American Poetry, really a summary of, a summary review of modernism. It is not such a bad thing for all of us. To most of you, this will seem basic, but I wanted to illustrate that a little background goes a long way. These redefinitions, what we are, what art is, what nature slash God is, what we are in cities in relation to our mental life, and the fact that these ideas called for dramatically new forms, that forms of art can include the thread-like, the fragmentary, the unfinished, that objects can point to their own synthetic quality. All these concepts are worth reminding students, even if Make It New is by now 100 years old. Many contemporary poetry readers find that the mysterious can participate in modernist modes, in tones, types, levels, styles that we take for granted in other aspects of our lives. It doesn't take more than half a day to present this a summary of modernism to students. And this is really true, I think, when I teach in writers' conferences, just sort of introducing the ideas of modernism that we live with every day. We just assume modernist reality in our daily lives, but when we encounter it in poetry, it seems foreign and completely frightening. And not having arrived at the 20th century is one of the many problems in Mr. Ashcroft's poem. I said I wasn't going to go into this poem too much. The fact that art comes from other art as well as from non-art, that it should be current, and that the dilemmas of our present poetry come from unresolved arguments about representation and expression in the 19th century should not dismay us. It is a good thing. As romantic emotion, symbolist moody alienation, surreal wild irrationality, or Russian formalist philosophy make their way into contemporary poetry, we can remind students that originality in art, as in the human genome, resides in the way things are reconfigured, and not in some God-given attribute, though I personally talk to rocks, plants, birds, and the piece of paper when I'm composing my own poetry, and thus do not want to put down people who think an actual muse still exists. Oracle bones of ancient China speak metaphorically through their ancestors' recirculating messages. An overwhelmed, busy, depressed, confused, or mystified contemporary student can depend on the poet to make expressive signs, give meaning, or usefully undermine meaning in the sounds of her time. I want to go through the fourfold toolkit I mentioned earlier, the sense of who we are in our environments, the sense that every word matters and can be of interest, that meaning circulates on many levels, and the strange mystery of our existence can be represented. To proceed inductively, I thought about some poems I have taught in the last few years and recalled some of the pedagogical challenges they present. Contemporary poetry has a huge range of approaches to this question of who we are. 19th century speakers in poetry, Wordsworth's hopeful meditations, Coleridge's depressed intimate ones, the symbolist Baudelaire's haunted outsider descriptions, Rambeau's hallucinatory narratives, Whitman's capacious sweep, Dickinson's uncanny metaphysical puzzles, provided 20th century poetry with a satura being a food medley, what the word satire comes from, of mental states. Eliot and Pound collage fragments of literature, polyphonies of urban, pastoral, medieval, Renaissance voices. Gertrude Stein assembles those human thought patterns in abstract cubist fashion. H.D. introduces Vatic and oracular lyricism. Williams uses concrete everyday American speech, and so on. Often the persona in poetry of the second half of the 20th century is mostly assumed to be the poet recounting an experience or series of thoughts about an experience in a narrative or meditative form. That it became the main mode in the 20th century is probably because the personal accounts have a particular appeal. and will continue to have. When students first come to poetry, they are excited that it can address their own states of feeling, their questions. Who am I and what is my problem? The lyric poem is still going steady with the turbulent heart that loves its own turbulence. The basic desire for emotional identification and the lack of it brings most people to poetry in the first place. No poet, no matter how avant-garde, forgets this power of emotion. My introductory students have often been exposed to Sylvia Plath's poetry and are drawn to it despite the perilous nature of her subject matter. Here is one of her poems, and it's Morning Song. Love set you going like a fat gold watch. The midwife slapped your foot soles and your bald cry took its place among the elements. Our voices echo, magnifying your arrival. New statue. In a drafty museum, your nakedness shadows our safety. We stand round blankly as walls. I'm no more your mother than the cloud that distills a mirror to reflect its own slow effacement at the wind's hand. All night, your moth breath flickers among the flat pink roses. I wake to listen. A far sea moves in my ear. One cry and I stumble from bed, cow heavy and floral in my Victorian nightgown. Your mouth opens clean as a cat's. The window square whitens and swallows its dull stars. And now you try your handful of notes. The clear vowels rise like balloons. Many students can enter this poem relatively easily. It is an apparently single speaker arrangement. Though Plath deploys wildly contradictory metaphors, her persona is a familiar figure, that of an exhausted new mother. The style is one of apparent realism. This could really happen. The poem depicts feelings in a setting most students, even if they don't have children, recognize. The new parent in the poem feels alienated from her new baby. Students can follow how Plath builds her personal myth. The baby is an arrival in a museum, the mother a rather detached presence who goes between feeling like a cloud and a cow. The images show the progress and irony of her condition as they range from surreal, moth breath, a window swallowing stars, to a hopeful, easier simile, vowels like balloons. When students are first studying poetry, they are often told it is bad to mix metaphors, but Plath, like Dickinson, wildly mixes metaphors in search of the transformation into a different realm, so it's good to interrogate prejudices about inconsistency. I wanted to present this as an example of a poem with difficult subject matter that is relatively easy to teach. More challenging to teach poetry that confuses this issue of who is speaking. I've often taught a book-length poem called Muse and Drudge by Harriet Mullen, who has been called the queen of hip hyperbole. The book, a lyric meditation that shakes up the question of speaker and speakingness, uses the style of a collage voice, a composite of many types of utterance. Its playfulness incessantly undermines our expectations of poetic procedure, mixing common aphorisms, song lyrics, cultural truisms, mottos, cliches, asides. Written in unpunctuated quatrains, each page of this 80-page book can be taken as a separate work. You can read each page by itself, each quatrain by itself, even each line as a separate poem. The beginning of the book, like any epic, invokes the muse figure, in this case Sapphire, punning on the lyric poet Sappho with her lyre, lyre. So this is number 4 there. Sapphire's lyre styles, plucked eyebrows, bow hips and legs, whose lives are lonely too. My last nerve's lucid music, sure chewed up the juicy fruit. You must don't like my peaches, there's some left on the tree. You've had my thrills, a reefer, a tub of gin. Don't mess with me, I'm evil, I'm in your sin. Clipped bird, eclipsed moon, soon no memory of you. No drive or desire survives. You flutter invisible still. One student noted, you know who's talking, but it's confusing to know what she's saying. Another said, "You don't know who's talking, but she has a really particular style of talking." Not being certain of who is speaking in a poem makes for a challenging experience and isn't always appealing to a junior English major endeavoring to find herself through poetry, or to identify with a group, to find the money to buy a sweatshirt with a hood, to believe someone will love only her. Poetry without an identifiable speaker or single emotional register may be a hard sell. It is inappropriate at every level to say to a student that it doesn't matter whether she finds herself in poetry or not. It is also inappropriate not to include many alternative strategies for self-discovery, such as this kind of poetry. Mullen's stanzas present multiple possibilities rather than assertions of bold certainty of what and who we are. Each line pursues its own logic and paratactic relation to others. The lines and phrases interact, and all this becomes the who is speaking. When students discuss the speaker issue here, the word polyvocal comes up, how the character in the poem pursues her cultural, sexual, ethnic critiques, taking references from jazz, literature from Renaissance to the present, movies, socio-political fusions, pop culture, braiding historical memory and retooling it. Mullen ironizes the very agility at which she excels, acting as a synthesizing presence, becoming an energetic trickster goddess, one who does not rely on notions of other gods or nature. The music in this vast poem seems a great deal like a montage in our heads. When we drive in a haze to work or school, we hear the corporate news of war, we sit ding, 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 downloading the email, we are on hold with the traffic department, the cell phone battery goes out, we hurry home to make dinner, or rather to bring home the takeout. Harriet Mullen has said of her writing that her inclination is to pursue what is minor, marginal, idiosyncratic, trivial, debased, or aberrant in a language that I speak and write. She says that she wishes to recycle familiar and humble materials in search of poetry of everyday language, puns, double entendres, taboo words, Freudian slips, jokes, riddles, proverbs, folk poetry. Like the oracle bone divining poets, the poet here pursues unity as an elusive ancestral collection of voices. It goes with the charge Wordsworth gives to poets in his preface to the Lyrical Ballads, to speak to and for all people. So that's just one example of speakingness that is, you know, I think aided by some of the complexities of poetry, actually. So number two tool in the toolkit, every word matters, what is she talking about? It is common to hear students talking about the idea behind the poem. There is no idea behind a poem, I say. The words and their phrases are what we have. Generally, it is helpful to know some of the cultural or historical context of the poem. It is interesting and somewhat relevant to know if the poem had a theoretical apparatus to accompany it. But basically, we have the poem on the page. Poetry asks us to attend to language very carefully, such that the qualities of individual words and their relationships matter more. Styles and theory of reading come and go over the centuries, and they don't all emphasize the evolution of diction. Paying attention to an attractive poem, like Falling in Love, occurs because something attracts you to an object of interest. Paying more attention makes for more love, but the attraction must be based on interest in the first place. Would the oracle bone diviner, paying attention to the signs, have been able to do his work if his signs had been uninteresting? The reader's job is to stay interested. Loving words is a way of staying interested. Think about the word special in its current usages. In the phrase United States Special Forces, the word special is resoundingly inspiring if one has a family member serving in Iraq with nationalistic conviction, but ironic if one is opposed to the present war. The same word special occurs in the same phrasal position in United States Special Olympics. Special Olympics, a beneficent necessity, doesn't allow the same ironic possibilities as does special forces. Once we become sensitized to its occasional ironies, we hear airlines have special fares, special meals. 50s movies, sometimes seen on Saturday, have Saturday night specials. Our children have invented a phrase for family quarrels during the Christmas season. Rather than saying a family member has issues or problems, we say he has a special topic. I love the word special. A contemporary poet who diligently attends to diction and loves minimalist forms is Carol Snow, whose book 4 isolates perceptions and phrases in service of both personal and cultural memory. Here is one of her poems in which each punctuation mark has implication, even each punctuation mark has implication and formal heft. News of another massacre and the clean, bright morning. Keeping walking, contradiction is human, I know that, and knowing, a stirring from the place, the whirlwind, something like fear arises, and watching my breath to still that, suddenly thinking somewhere in the breath, along the breath, is an understood place, somewhere, but somewhere in passing, from where the matter is reconciled. This poem opens with a reference to explicit political content, but the reference is generalized. A student might ask about this problem of reference. How do we know when to care? What is the difference between obscure and oblique references, the evocative and the obfuscating? A student without experience in literary exegesis might make up a wild narrative or, on the side, using her favorite noun, she may become annoyed and say, why does Carol Snow get to do this and I don't? Eliot and Pound gave modern readers a sense that specific cultural and historical references are stand-ins for universal nature and for the minds of writers. Many references in poetry may be glossed or Googled. It's harder with private allusion. Yet it's possible to get a bushel of emotive information from the symbolic nature of an image, especially if you trust your ear, and your ear is a great aid here. Bob Dylan's Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands begins with images that might be right out of Rambo's turbulent symbolism, with your mercury mouth and your missionary eyes, with your eyes like smoke, to describe the attributes of a lover who has timeless mystique. Massacre is one of those words with a tremendous symbolic maze inside of it. A student might ask, how can I relate to this poem unless I know whether the poet refers to Uganda, Kosovo, Rwanda, Darfur? Because massacre is a nearly unbearable word, it puts the human imagination into an unbearable place. The OED shows how this word has evolved and devolved. Massacre, in the sense of the brutal slaughter of people in huge numbers, has in it the French massacre, merely a slaughterhouse, but before that, Latin macella or macella, a butcher shop, and before that, massacarius, a provision dealer. The horror of the word is intensified throughout history as common usage accretes, sheds, and fuses meaning into it, so that the massacre in Snow's poem is Herod's massacre, the Huguenots, Native American peoples, the massacre in Croatia. Concurrently, there's also the de-intensification of the word. Massacre is sometimes used about college football games. Whirlwind is also a diction moment of note, often used in conjunction with romance, whirlwind romance. Whirlwind is notably used in the Bible when Prophet Elijah is taken up into one, and it came to pass, as they still went on and talked, that behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, and parted them both asunder, and Elijah went up by whirlwind into heaven. And whirlwinds of romance and Elijah coexist. Not only can they, but the poet demands that they must. Snow's whirlwind, a small matter on a city street, is stripped of neither of these possibilities. Context seizes the word for itself. There's a memorable sentence about this sort of thing in R.P. Blackmer's essay on Wallace Stevens. I'm totally in love with R.P. Blackmurva. Just, if you know, if you can just sort of go back and have huge literary crushes, I have a total literary crush on R.P. Blackmurva. And he's just, every sentence of his writing about literature. When Wallace Stevens' Sea Surface Full of Clouds, Blackmurva comments, "Words like sensations are blind facts which, put together, produce a feeling no part of which was in the data." I think that's just, I just, his writing on that poem is just amazing. It's just an amazing poem in itself. Snow's poem commemorates breath, a breath carrying the body through and past a terrifying thought. Her multiple use of the ing endings, mourning, keeping, walking, stirring, knowing, something, watching, make a rope ladder of gerunds and participles across the breath chasm, giving the poem a sense of process and of the present moment. The ing is a present tense sort of device and a grammatical synesthesia, making verb forms out of nouns and adjectives and vice versa. The tentativeness of Snow's sentence structure, its jagged, bumpy surface, foregrounds the way the need for acceptance collides with a sense of powerlessness. Sentence fragments slip up on each other. There are six periods and only two sentences. This halting, disrupted quality can be hard for students to absorb. A vocabulary value students often bring to class is a vague emphasis on what they call flow. "I like this because it flows easily," someone will say. Flow as in an oil spill? What makes flow an inherent good, we might ask? Do your lives always flow, or do you ever have an unpleasant thought interrupting your day? Has a wave of desire ever entered you suddenly? If disruption is part of life, it is part of art. A new diction exercise I've given students is to archive good spam from the internet. It's not exactly a muse in the classic sense, but pharmaceutical advertising provides immediate access to the realm of unconscious in diction. My spam folder includes treachery reclaim, arsonist fritter, my chemicals cardinal of the planetary's most broadly inflicted antidepressants, and erection for less, easy ordering, sincerely, Esmeralda Fang. Esmeralda Fang could be another of Bob Dylan's women, like Madame Butterfly and the Sad-Eyed Lady. Ashcroft might want to lower his spam filter a bit. So this is the third of my four tools here. Thinking on many levels, or can't you just say it simply? If Snow's poem isolates phrases to slow down the thought process, the next poem by Mamie Bersenbrugge deploys an almost opposite strategy. It is a syntactically turbulent poem. Its sentences are multi-grammatical, polylogical, and its logics are hard to follow. But you can follow them, and it does flow in a surprising way. Bersenbrugge uses techniques of collage and montage from visual art to show the seams and the constructed nature of her perceptions. She layers physical observations, speculations, and commentary in process analysis, mostly in declarative sentences. Texas. "I used the table as a reference and just did things from there in register to play a form of feeling out to the end, which is an air of truth living objects and persons you use take on when you set them together in a certain order, conferring privilege on the individual who will tend to dissolve if his visual presence is maintained into a sensation of meaning going off by itself. First, the table is the table. In blue light or in electric light, it has no pathos. Then light separates from the human content, a violent colored net or immaterial haze, echoing the violent ice plant on the windowsill, where he is the trace of desire. Such emotions are interruptions in landscape and in logic, brought on by a longing for direct experience, as if her memory of experience were the trace of herself. Especially now, when things have been flying apart in all directions, she will consider the hotel lobby the inert state of a form. It is the location of her appointment. and the gray enamel elevator doors are the relational state, the place behind them being a ground of water or the figure of water. Now she turns her camera on them to change her thinking about them into a thought in Mexico, as the horizon when you are moving can oppose the horizon inside the elevator via a blue Cadillac into a long tracking shot. You linger over your hand at the table. The light becomes the gold wing on the table. She sees it opening with an environment inside that is plastic and infinite, but is a style that has got the future wrong. This poem is in a style that has got the future right. It deploys several basic modernist techniques, especially those of Gertrude Stein writing in a cubist manner, placing phrases and sentences in an angular way to make an effect of uneven surfaces. This kind of writing derives some of its enchantment from having antecedents in a sentence disappear. Antecedent nouns and pronouns seem swallowed. It gathers force from abstract expressionist painting, the way a paint stroke might meet the maybe of a thought or shape. When I try to teach this poem, there's often resistance, a balkiness extraordinaire. Why can't she say it straight? What is she trying to say? She should just write normally. At first, it makes them angry. They think of this, in fact, I was talking to one of my grad students who was just trying to teach the same poem to a group of undergrads, and so this is the same set of comments. They think of this kind of work as a hothouse flower that requires too much care. They don't want to spend the time when it's hard to get the emotional thrust of it. I ask them to bring their own impressions to the piece, even if they want antecedents and the emotional register of the poem to be obvious and clear. If they respond with distress to what seems like its arbitrary nature, it's useful to have them distinguish between writing that relies on chance operations, everything being arbitrary, Jackson Maclow's poems, and writing that uses indirection in, you know, a very purposeful way. Marjorie Perloff, Stephen Bird, and others have written in really wonderful ways about how contemporary poetry does this. Most of the sentences in Texas use a shift in perspective. As the pronouns in the course of an unfolding sentence become unhinged from their antecedents, the poem accumulates and does not relinquish multiple perspectives. In the first sentence, which continues for six lines, the you part of the sentence could be the I talking to the general you, to another specific you, or to herself. The second stanza assumes the perspective of a she. The third stanza is in the perspective of a you and a she. The free-floating references take on a bit of life of their own as the light is doing in the piece. There are always odd angles when we're trying to figure out how light strikes objects. Photons have no mass, but tables do. Borsenbrugge suggests that just as light and its effects on the table can be thought of at a slant, so can thought or a phenomenon of feeling. The irregular non-grammatical syntax might cause an experience of uneasiness with the illusion of wholeness. The metaphysical version of this observation appears in Dickinson's There's a Certain Slant of Light. How can an instructor teach students to love a kind of beauty that is counter to normal beauty? I hope I'm suggesting that there are many kinds of normal. You cannot teach love, but you can demonstrate causes for love. Walking outside a museum after having seen a powerful art show, you see the world through the painter's eyes. Certain kinds of poetry bring that experience too, of perceiving the world differently from having been exposed to different angles. One's relationship to space has been changed, as if one entered a haze of otherness that is not ego-bound. This is eccentric but not private. It expands perception, has a strange relationship to its feeling tone, but doesn't give itself over easily. Yet I have a strong emotional response when I read it. And since I write poetry that contains epistemological argument, I like teaching such work. Texas comes from a strong strain of skepticism. Either it is possible to represent the world and our feelings for it directly, or it is not. The poem is called has learned to accept ambiguous states with a longing for reality. Barbara Guest calls this fair realism. My Brazilian-born mother calls it saudades, a longing for home when one is already home. Estou com saudades in Portuguese, to describe a state of yearning for an elsewhere that is present. And this is my final point here, approaching strange states with poetry like this. My fourth knowledge tool will remain mostly in the realm of suggestion. Poetry allows the mind to come into contact with an impossible oddness of everything. Andrew Joron, in an essay, has called this the unsayable. I mostly call it the spirit of the world. Jung calls it the collective unconscious, but it's all, you know, this sort of version of what we're barely at the edge of all the time in our experience, and we're always trying to move toward the rational to function. Here's another poem I've taught often. It's by Alice Notley, and like my other examples, addresses what might be called, described as a form of existential anxiety. When I was alive. When I was alive, I wore a thin dress, bare shoulders, the heat of the white sun, and my black thin dress did envelop me, till I was a shell, gladly, and breeze ruffled and filled against good legs, the translucent fabric, and my heart transparent, as I walk toward Marion's and Helena's, as my skirt empties and fills with cooling air. Notley's poetry, like other work from the New York School second generation in the 60s and 70s, has associated itself with art and with recovering a process orientation in poetry, with styles of unassuming fresh meditation, non-literariness, and natural-sounding speech tones. Teaching this poem, one might begin by isolating the shift in verb tense. When I was alive, the title puts forth, and the apparent I speaks out or into a different state, from a seemingly posthumous state, or from a state which contrasts with aliveness, something that once existed and now doesn't. Students are often made uneasy by the fact that the action changes from past tense in three quarters of the poem to present tense in the last stanza. The woman speaking remembers an experience of walking along in a thin dress toward the places of two women named Marion and Helena. She notes the transparency of the fabric and of her heart. The tone for the first two stanzas is lightly, sweetly elegiac and changes just as the speaker's dress loses physicality. The jaunty tone seems hard to manage for a ghostly person. Why is there no punctuation? The ontogenic uncertainty of the persona seems intensified as the breeze whips through the unpunctuated song-like quatrains as if through small city streets. In the way Keats's poetic persona knows he can't be the nightingale, doesn't want to be the nightingale, but wants to want to want to be the nightingale, or rather doesn't want to die, the floating, alive, dead, reborn woman in the poem might be in sync with all those Keatsian desires, and even the desires to be another wonderful bird. The one in Yeats's Sailing to Byzantium that makes its poet so happy only by being golden and unflappable, the symbol for art in spiritual realms. If students don't know what they are supposed to feel about the meaning of an experience presented or about its tone, it seems to be a light poem, even a bit fey, about being in motion and solitude, this uncertainty in relation to things or in events is brought to you by the 20th century. This poem privileges the sense of process over destination. It isn't that the woman is in any one place, but that she is in process as the many points of searching. This brings the deeply personal and social moments of a day into temporary focus. Notley's poetic stand-in is not alienated from herself and from her own mind for very long. I do think this sort of art connects us both to our ancestral states, like the oracle bone script, and to new ones. So to conclude, teaching, reading, and studying poetry does not substitute for other kinds of moral activity. For me, these activities are very important and exist beside my spiritual practice of writing and meditation, and also besides social and political activism, which will have to be the subject of another talk. But I heartily believe that the habits of mind learned from reading and engaging with poetry can counter a culture of greed, narcissism, and blind destruction, and help the poetry reader live with patience and attentiveness. I urge you to keep a great range of poetry in your lives. If you run out of poetic ideas, email me at St. Mary's, as I always have something I'm excited about, usually a long list. Any temporary difficulties of confronting the challenges of poetry will be assuaged by boundless possibilities of perception it offers, just as at the moment I'm writing this, the scratching of a fern with the black orderly seeds at the window, the squirrel building its IKEA of twigs, and the huge national debt provide a context of other kinds of perception. The constructed world exists in relation to an unknowable, endangered world. Stevens writes in The Necessary Angel, "The subject matter of poetry is not a collection of solid, static objects extended in space, but the life that is lived in the scene it composes. You make some sense of things as if you were your own diviner of signs, as if the cracks in the oracle bone were details brought from this world into this world." Thank you.
That was Brenda Hillman speaking at the Morrison Library on the University of California, Berkeley campus on May 5th, 2006. Hillman's lecture was the third of the Judith Lee Stronach Memorial Lectures on the Teaching of Poetry. The recording was provided by the Bancroft Library and is used with permission of the University of California, Berkeley. Brenda Hillman has published 8 books of poetry. Her most recent collection is called Practical Water and was published in 2009 by Wesleyan University Press. You can read more about Brenda Hillman and some of her poems at poetryfoundation.org. You'll also find many other articles about poets and poetry, an online archive of more than 9,000 poems, and other audio programs to download. I'm Ed Herman. Thanks for listening to Poetry Lectures from poetryfoundation.org.